And so is talking to people. Amazing how much they'll tell you if you only inquire. And I imagine there should be something interesting to a London season as well. But none of it changed my mind about marriage, since none of it changed the economic and political equation that is marriage. I do not like the idea of bartering the use of my reproductive system for a man's support, not in the absence of other choices. Livia's eyes bulged. The old Charlotte had never gone anywhere. She'd been but reupholstered in fine muslin and a jauntily angled hat. Livia was ashamed that this simple camouflage had fooled her completely. "And you told him that?" "That he already knows. What I told him today was that I'd settled on a choice of career. I believe I will make a fine headmistress at a girls' school. If I achieve that position at a reputable school, I can earn as much as £500 a year." Livia sucked in a breath. "That much? Yes. But I cannot become a headmistress overnight. I must attend school, undertake the required training, and then work my way up the ranks. I asked Papa to foot the expenses until I can pay him back."
"And he is amenable to it?"
"Our agreement is that I will wait until I'm 25. If by then I still haven't found anyone I wish to marry, then yes, he will sponsor my schooling." Livia was flabbergasted.
"I can't believe it."
"He gave his word as a gentleman."
A man's word was no trifling matter, so Livia shook her head. She supposed she must believe now that Sir Henry had made a serious promise.
"But it'll be a long time before you turn 25. Almost 8 years. Anything could happen in the meanwhile. You could fall in love." "That's what Papa is counting on, no doubt. But romantic love is... I don't wish to say that romantic love itself is a fraud. I'm sure the feelings it inspires are genuine enough, however temporary. But the way it's held up as this pristine, everlasting joy every woman ought to strive for, when, in fact, love is more like beef brought over from Argentina on refrigerated ships. It might stay fresh for a while under carefully controlled conditions, but sooner or later its qualities will begin to degrade. Love is, by and large, a perishable good, and it is lamentable that young people are asked to make irrevocable till death do we part decisions in the midst of a short-lived euphoria." Livia's jaw hung open. She, too, had doubts about love and marriage, but they centred largely around her fear of coming across as arrogant and off-putting to potential suitors, and on whether she'd be able to choose better than Lady Holmes had. It had yet to occur to her to form large-scale judgments on the entire system. "But what about the Cummingses? They've been married 30 years, and they're still happy with each other. And there are the Archibalds and the Smalls, too. But we mustn't be sentimental about the success of those marriages. We must look at it mathematically, the number of long-term happily married couples in proportion to all married couples. By my estimation, that comes to less than 20% among our acquaintances. Will you bet on that kind of odds?"
Livia blinked several times.
"I take it you won't? Those wouldn't be bad odds at all if we were at a horse race. And they aren't such terrible odds if we consider that the prize is decades of contented companionship. My problem lies with the stake I'm required to put up. My entire lifetime. Not to mention, unless I bury my husband or divorce him, I can play only once. And of course, if I were to divorce my husband, my parents can never show their faces anywhere again. I'll have effectively done them in, too. So, no. Given the exorbitant costs and constraints, I am not willing to take this gamble." She tugged at Livia. Belatedly, Livia realized that they'd come to a stop some time ago, and that she stood in the way of an oncoming dog cart.
She allowed Charlotte to guide her to the edge of the dirt lane and nodded mechanically at the village doctor who drove past, tipping his hat. "I take it you plan to wait for your 25th birthday, then thumb your nose at society and go to school," she said, when they resumed walking again.
"More or less. Papa asked me to make a good-faith effort to let a man sweep me off my feet, and I've agreed. But I don't know why he thinks I'll weigh contributing factors differently when I'm off my feet. Sometimes I feel I must conclude that Papa doesn't know me at all."
That was a deduction that needed no comment. It was Livia's opinion that Sir Henry still viewed Charlotte as an amusing oddity, or at least still hoped she'd return to being such, if he ignored her radical thinking long enough. And it certainly didn't help matters that Charlotte looked as she did, so emphatically and one might even say extravagantly feminine, all rotundity and softness, not a sharp angle anywhere.
"Well," said Livia, "I've heard that kissing does affect a lady's thinking. I've been kissed. It's very nice, but I..."
"What? Who kissed you? When and where?"
"It was several years ago, but I've pledged to never divulge the gentleman's name, which means I also can't tell you where the kiss took place, since that would narrow the list of likely candidates."
"Several years ago?"
Charlotte would have been only 13 or 14 at the time.
"You never said a thing. You never asked. I..."
Livia decided she had better shut up before she blurted out that she could scarcely have wondered whether Charlotte was kissing boys, when she had half suspected Charlotte had been sent from Mars to investigate the cultural observances of Earthlings.
"How did it happen? Did it take you by surprise?"
"Not at all. I set it in motion."
"Charlotte! Were you in love?"
"No. I wanted to know what it felt like."
"But how did you pick the boy? Surely you didn't draw a name out of a hat?"
Livia gasped.
"Or did you?"
"I didn't do that. But I can't reveal the circumstances that led me to choose him, since that would also give clues to his identity."
Livia tried a few more times, but Charlotte remained amiably tight-lipped. Livia gave up.
"Look at you. You had a very nice kiss, and you've got a plan of action for your life. That makes me feel completely aimless."
"Usually one feels aimless because one isn't sure yet what one wants. Until one does, a proper strategy can't be formulated."
Charlotte studied Livia a moment.
"But in your case, it's possible you know exactly what you want, but you're afraid to want it, let alone pursue it."
Livia swallowed. She didn't ask Charlotte what or how she knew. She didn't say anything at all. They walked in silence the rest of the way. As they approached the house, Livia wrapped her arm around Charlotte's shoulders.
"What if everything Papa promised was only to mollify you temporarily? It gives me no pleasure to say this, but our father isn't terribly far-sighted. He'd be happy to postpone a problem for another day, let alone another 8 years. What if, when the time comes, he reneges on his word?"
"I don't know. Not yet, in any case. I'll have plenty of time to consider my response."
Charlotte took Livia's hand in her own.
"But if our father should prove a man of his word and sponsor the necessary education and training for me to earn a living, will you allow me to do the same for you in return?"
Livia squeezed Charlotte's hand, suddenly close to tears. Charlotte seldom initiated physical contact. This was as solemn an offer as the Queen could make, standing in the middle of Westminster Abbey.
"Yes," she said. "Yes, please do."
She allowed herself to be briefly carried away by visions of this impossible future. Two sisters, united in a most gratifying independence. Would they have a little cottage?
or a nice, spacious suite of rooms at the girls' school that Charlotte would direct. She could see them sipping tea together on Sunday afternoons, Charlotte with a plate of her beloved plum cake in front of her, looking out to a small garden reserved for their private use. It was a more appealing future than any she'd imagined yet. But pessimist that she was, she couldn't let the occasion pass without a word of caution. "Remember, Charlotte, Papa doesn't like women. He'd feel a lot more hesitation breaking his word to a man, but you aren't a man." He had one fiancée who jilted him because of his character flaws, and the woman he married to spite the fiancée dislikes him because he used her with little regard for her feelings. What reason does he have to dislike all women? Does he disdain all men because his father was an ass and his solicitor made a soup of his affairs? By your standards, it isn't rational, I know. But you can't expect to be treated rationally when you are a woman, Charlotte. I can't explain why. That's just how it is. And you must learn to accept it. Charlotte was quiet. Livia thought that perhaps, for once, she'd put some sense into her little sister's head. But as they walked back into the house, Charlotte turned to her and said, "I will try to understand why, but I will not learn to accept it. Never." Livia had long suspected that Sir Henry would not hold to his promise. And yet, when it happened, when he broke his pledge, she was far angrier than her sister. "It's unconscionable what he did, to lie to you so boldly, to ask you to act in good faith when he hadn't the slightest intention of upholding his end of the bargain," she sputtered, unable to go on. Charlotte sat at the edge of their bed, the slow tapping of her fingertips on the bedpost, the only sign of her agitation. After a long minute, Charlotte said, "My timing was less than ideal. I didn't know it before I spoke to him, but Lady Amelia Drummond was found dead this morning. Papa was in a minor state." Livia's hand came up to her throat. "Oh." Charlotte played with a bow on her skirt. "This isn't to say that he would have kept his word otherwise. If he meant to keep his word, he would have, whether or not Lady Amelia still breathed. But had there been any vacillation on his part, any remote chance that he might have changed his mind at the last minute, as I said, my timing wasn't ideal." "Will you ask him again? Do you think that would be any use?"
"No,
neither do I."
"Then what are you going to do?"
Livia was fuming again.
"Please tell me you won't swallow this appalling deceit. Papa will feel no remorse. He will only be endlessly smug that he got away with this kind of disgraceful chicanery."
Charlotte wrapped her hands around the bedpost. If it were Livia, she'd be imagining the bedpost to be Sir Henry's throat. But Charlotte retained her usual tranquillity as she replied, "No, I won't let it pass without a suitable response."
"Good,"
cried Livia, then a little less certainly.
"But what kind of response would do the trick? How can you both punish him and still extract the necessary funds for your education?"
"I have an idea. I will think about it."
"Can I be of help?"
"It'll be best if I handle it myself." Livia was taken aback.
You aren't going to put arsenic in his tea or anything like that, are you?"
"No, of course not. Besides, his death would offer no financial advantage to us at all. That's when his creditors will pounce. Mama will have to sell the house to satisfy them, and I will not receive a penny for my education."
"Then what?"
"I'll tell you when it's done." A chill ran down Livia's spine. Her sister could be ruthless in her own way.
"Will you at least tell me when you'll implement this diabolical plan of yours?"
"Soon. Within weeks, I should think." Livia took Charlotte by the shoulders. Don't do anything you'll regret.
Charlotte's lips stretched into a smile that did not reach her eyes. Would that someone had given Papa that warning?
In the following days, Livia pestered Charlotte for more details about the plan. But Charlotte only smiled, shook her head, and carried on as usual. It was the season, with its attendant rounds of afternoon garden parties and evening dances. The whirl of merrymaking, however, had long ago lost what little appeal it had for Livia. The ultimate purpose of this yearly assembly wasn't fun and games. It was for unmarried ladies to find husbands, and married ones to jostle for social prominence. Livia wouldn't say she'd never met any gentlemen who appealed to her, but those of lofty enough qualities to interest her never seemed to be interested in her, and those who did bother to pay attention to her failed to spark the least reciprocal warmth on her part. A sorry outcome, to say the least. After Charlotte's thoroughly unromantic analysis of the institution of marriage, Livia had been on guard against runaway emotions that might lead to regrettable choices. But this resolute lack of runaway emotions was dispiriting in its own way. One ought to fall in love at least once, oughtn't one? If only to understand what Elizabeth Barrett Browning had meant when she'd written, "The face of all the world is changed, I think, since first I heard the footsteps of thy soul." Yet this common, practically universal experience evaded Livia everywhere she went. And, of course, for her mother, Livia's failure to garner a single proposal in 7.5 seasons was a shameful burden to bear, a burden that Livia must hear of weekly, sometimes daily. Lady Holmes's latest tirade lasted the entirety of their ride home. They were alone in the carriage, it being Charlotte's afternoon at the reading room of the British Museum, and the brougham was stuck in one of London's horrible traffic log jams that took an hour to clear. Livia was exhausted by the time she escaped to her room. She feared she was coming dangerously close to the point when she would begin to encourage anyone at all with a matrimonial interest in her, to get away from her mother, if nothing else. If Charlotte would only succeed somehow in her endeavour. But every passing day sapped Livia's confidence that any good would come of Sir Henry's betrayal, that Charlotte would somehow rise triumphantly, phoenix-like, from the ashes of her hopes. The sound of metal tyres coming to a stop drew her to a window. Charlotte usually walked home from the British Museum, and the hour for ordinary calls was well past. Who could be pulling up to their front door? An unfamiliar town coach disgorged Charlotte, followed by... What in the world was Charlotte doing with the Dowager Baroness Shrewsbury? Lady Shrewsbury was the last person who would set foot in the reading room, so Charlotte couldn't possibly have met her there. And even if she had, ever since Charlotte had turned down a marriage proposal from Lady Shrewsbury's son, Lady Shrewsbury had been chilly toward the Holmeses, finding it an outrage that a girl from a family of lesser pedigree and standing had decreed her Roger to be not nearly good enough. From her vantage point, Livia hadn't been able to see Charlotte's face properly, but something in her posture didn't feel right. Livia opened the door of their bedroom, but there was no indication that Charlotte was coming upstairs. What could Lady Shrewsbury possibly want with Charlotte? Below, her parents were headed for the parlour, exchanging whispered words with each other, sounding just as baffled as to Lady Shrewsbury's presence. After all, Roger was now married. All the Baroness's sons were married, so she couldn't have good news to announce involving Charlotte and any kinsman of hers. They entered the parlour. Lady Shrewsbury's voice called firmly for the door to be closed. She also instructed the footman that there would be no need for tea. Livia's heart dropped a few rungs. What was going on? She took a deep breath, tiptoed down the stairs, and sidled as quietly as she could to the door of the parlour.
An absolute disgrace. What girls these days think, I have no idea. To turn down Roger's proposal, only to indulge in a shameless affair with him 6 years later, as an unmarried woman, no less.
Livia covered her mouth. Dear God, no. This couldn't possibly have been Charlotte's response to Sir Henry.
Lady Shrewsbury raged on, her words sloshing in and out Livia's hearing, a tide of undifferentiated syllables, carrying no meaning except wrath and ruin. At some point Lady Shrewsbury stopped and Sir Henry spoke, his words too soft for Livia to hear. Lady Shrewsbury laughed derisively.
"Keep it from spreading? No, my good sir, that horse has bolted the barn. By dinner time tonight, everyone in London will know what your daughter has been caught doing today. But even if that weren't the case, I would make sure that she is shunned from every respectable drawing room in the land. Her conduct is beyond the pale, and no good family should tolerate any association with a girl of such abominably loose morals."
"My daughter has committed an unforgivable sin," said Sir Henry, his voice tight yet defeated. "But has your son fared any better? No gentleman would take up with an unmarried young lady from a good family. Does he not share some of the blame?"
"He does."
Lady Shrewsbury sounded as if she were speaking through a mouthful of sand.
"And he will hear from his wife and myself. But men are creatures of unbound lust. It is the duty of good women to keep them in check. For your daughter to lure my son from home and hearth. For her to..."
Livia turned and ran back upstairs, so that she wouldn't kick in the door, grip Lady Shrewsbury by the front of her bodice, and start screaming. What luring of her son from home and hearth? Roger Shrewsbury already kept a mistress in St. John's Wood, had kept a string of mistresses there over the years, one of the reasons Charlotte turned him down. In the room she shared with Charlotte, Livia paced, her footsteps heavy and frantic. She sat down for a while, rocking back and forth at the edge of a chair before leaping up to pace again. When Lady Shrewsbury drove off in her carriage, she rushed downstairs, only to find the parlour door still closed and her mother shouting inside. Ever since, she'd been waiting for Lady Holmes to stop yelling. At last a small silence fell. Lady Holmes trudged to a chair at the far end of the room and sank into it with a graceless whomp. Charlotte sat, very primly, with her hands folded together in her lap. Her face was splotchy with Lady Holmes's hand marks, and her coiffure appeared slightly askew, as if missing a few pins that would have better kept it in place. But otherwise, she looked calm and collected, not at all like a woman about to be shunned by everyone she'd ever met. Did she understand what had happened? Or had this been her plan from the very beginning? Sir Henry spoke for the first time since Lady Shrewsbury's departure.
"Is this what you intended, Charlotte? To bring discredit and reproach upon the entire family?
Is this your retaliation for my failure to keep my word?" Or at least that was what Livia heard.
Charlotte looked in Livia's direction, as if she knew exactly who was on the other side of the door and what questions tumbled about in Livia's head.
"No. My plan involved no publicity whatsoever. Despite my long-standing wish to seek education and respectable employment, despite promises some in this room have made to me, in the end it became clear that I was not to be allowed any path except matrimony, which is an eminently unsuitable choice for me. So I decided to take the logical next step, remove my maidenhead, and therefore nullify my marital eligibility."
Lady Holmes leaped to her feet,
But that is the most stupid, absurd and—
Lady Holmes, we have heard enough from you today, Sir Henry growled. Charlotte, continue.
I needed a man. Moreover, I needed a man who cannot be compelled to marry me, therefore a married man. This presented some difficulty, as most married gentlemen I know would refuse me on grounds of either principle or caution. So I had to settle for someone who is both amoral and somewhat reckless. Mr. Shrewsbury fit my criteria perfectly. Unfortunately, he is also an idiot. Yesterday evening he returned home roaring drunk from a birthday celebration, mistook his wife for his mistress, and proceeded to tell her all about our agreement, time and venue included.
Lady Holmes gasped loudly.
But that is reprehensible. Why did not Mrs. Shrewsbury or Lady Shrewsbury come to us then, so that we could prevent your execrably ill-considered plan from going forward?
Why, indeed. But you need not be so outraged, Mama. You would have done the same thing, keeping the intelligence quiet until such a time when you could appear with a regular jury box of witnesses to catch the offending couple in flagrante delicto.
Lady Holmes sputtered.
Oh, I see.
You don't think you did anything wrong, Miss Charlotte, do you? Are you so selfish that you cannot think beyond yourself? Who will marry Livia now, with the family's reputation dragged through mud?
Livia had to restrain herself from throttling her mother. Charlotte's life had been ruined. Would no one think of her? What would she do for the rest of her life?
Well, you will have plenty of time to contemplate it now.
Lady Holmes' voice was once again climbing rapidly in pitch and volume.
You'll spend the rest of your life in the back cottage at home. No one will call on you. No one will write you. No one will care in the least whether you live or die.
Yes, I suppose,
said Charlotte softly, almost inaudibly. Livia couldn't control herself any more. She threw open the door.
Charlotte!
Charlotte rose, a wan smile on her face.
Livia.
Livia ran to her sister and embraced her.
Oh, Charlotte, what a horrible day.
For her? Said Lady Holmes sharply. It is you who will pay the price for her infamy.
You think I give a farthing for that?
Livia took her sister by the elbow.
Come upstairs, Charlotte. I'll ring for a tray of tea. You must be hungry.
You won't take her anywhere. I am not finished with her.
Yes, you are. For the rest of the evening, at least.
Lady Holmes wore an almost comical look of surprise. Livia was the Holmes daughter most likely to scowl, but she was rarely openly disobedient. Taking advantage of her mother's momentary stupefaction, Livia made off with Charlotte. 3. Inspector Treddles had first heard of the name Sherlock Holmes 2 years earlier. The Treddleses had joined Lord Ingram for a dig on the Isles of Scilly. It never failed to surprise Treddles that he was affiliated with a man of such elevated circumstances, but their friendship was as warm as it was unlikely. The excursion had been an especially good one, the days balmy and clear, the landscape a heart-stopping green against a shallow sea that was almost turquoise at times. At each meal the companions luxuriated in conversation and camaraderie. And late at night, conversation and camaraderie continued in private, between the inspector and his wife in their tent, augmented by tender lovemaking. The pearls came up one evening. Not long before, at Easter dinner with his wife's family, Mr. Barnaby Cousins, Treddle's brother-in-law, had complained bitterly about a pair of expensive earrings he had bought for his wife, and which had disappeared 10 days prior. Shortly before Mrs. Cousins dismissed her maid.
Mr. Cousins simply could not understand why the matter hadn't been handed to the police.
"If a servant steals a spoon," he had thundered, "you dismiss her without a letter of character. Those pearls cost a fortune. Of course, one never wants one's door darkened by a constable, but this one could have used the service entrance, and the housekeeper could have taken care of the matter."
Remembering himself, Mr. Cousins had nodded stiffly at Treddles, then still only a sergeant.
"Present company accepted, of course." "Of course," Treddles had replied.
Mr. Cousins berated his wife for another 5 minutes. Treddles would have had more sympathy for Mrs. Cousins if she weren't as disagreeable as her husband, and he'd have forgotten the matter if Alice, his wife, hadn't commented later how odd it was that Mrs. Cousins hadn't turned to the law. "She abhors any hint of criminality on the part of staff. I would have expected her to at least have said something to me, in order that word would reach your ear. And I did visit at the time, remember? She was so upset, Barnaby demanded that I call on her." Lord Ingram, as was his wont, listened carefully to their account. 2 nights later, he asked Alice whether Mrs. Cousins frequently suspected wrongdoing on the part of her staff. "And how?" answered Alice. "I should hate to be in service in her house."
"You wouldn't by any chance have noticed any strong odours when you visited her, shortly after the disappearance of the earrings?"
Alice leaned back in surprise. "Now that you mention it, I do remember thinking that my sister-in-law's rooms smelled pungently sour. But how did you know that, my lord?"
"I hadn't the least inkling, Mrs. Treddles," replied Lord Ingram, a rather mysterious expression on his face. "But I know someone named Holmes, who enjoys such little puzzles. I sent a note, with all references to names and locales redacted, of course, and a reply came today with these questions to ask."
"How interesting. Will you now write back to Mr. Holmes with the answers to his questions?"
Lord Ingram's eyes gleamed. "That will not be necessary." Holmes had instructed that should the answers to both questions be yes, I may go ahead and tell you that it is Holmes's theory that Mrs. Cousins's suspicions got the better of her sense. More specifically, she became convinced that her maid had stolen her precious pearls and replaced them with a pair of replicas, French imitations, which are said to be able to fool the eyes of an expert. To prove that it was indeed the case, she dropped the earrings into a container filled with hot vinegar, ergo the odour in her rooms, because paste pearls would not dissolve in vinegar. Alice gasped.
"And the pearls must have dissolved, fully or partially, which proved her maid's innocence, but destroyed the expensive earrings."
"No wonder she needed to take to her bed," exclaimed Treddles. "And no wonder she couldn't have her maid charged with any crime when her own stupidity was her undoing."
"Oh, but she did dismiss the poor woman without a letter of character, after 7 years of service." Alice set her hand on her husband's sleeve. "We must find her, so that I may provide a letter of character for her, and to amend for my sister-in-law's unkindness."
"Consider it done, my dear."
Treddles turned back to Lord Ingram.
"But this Holmes fellow is marvellous." "Holmes's mind has always been a thing of beauty," said Lord Ingram with a slight smile.
2 months later, while dining out with Lord Ingram in town, Alice related a tragic but curious case that came to her via her physician, Dr. Motley, who had learned of it many years ago from a colleague. The colleague had attended a prominent family. The daughter of the house, who was about 14 at the time, had suffered for a while from a deep melancholia. One morning, by all appearances, she passed away peacefully in her sleep. The parents, though devastated, believed it to have been an act of God that their child was now in a much better place. The family physician, however, could not bring himself to put faith in such a fairy tale. He dared not voice his thoughts aloud to the parents, but he did confide in Motley his suspicion that the girl had committed suicide, even though he couldn't find any evidence to that effect. She had on occasion taken a sip of her mother's laudanum to help her sleep, but the draught was always measured out carefully by the mother, drop by drop. No empty bottles of morphine or chloral lay by the girl's bedside. No signs of suffering or struggle that would have betrayed the involvement of arsenic or cyanide. She had said goodnight to her parents, a perfectly healthy young woman, and in the morning they had found themselves sobbing over her inert body. "Perhaps your friend Holmes can solve this terrible riddle, my lord," Alice had said to Lord Ingram. The next evening, Inspector Treddles received a note from Lord Ingram. He had a question from Holmes. Was soda water made on the premises for the consumption of the household? As it so happened, Alice, calling on her father, whose health was deteriorating, had run into Motley the following day. She took the opportunity to pose the question. A surprised Motley had answered in the affirmative. Yes. He believed that the staff at the house did procure canisters of liquid carbon dioxide to make soda water. Treddles passed on the intelligence to Lord Ingram. An answer came in due time. According to Holmes, as relayed by Lord Ingram, the girl had died of self-inflicted hypercapnia. When liquid carbon dioxide evaporated, the process dramatically lowered the surrounding temperature, so that some of the liquid carbon dioxide froze into a solid, a phenomenon someone in the house might have shown her. On the night of her death, she could have replicated that process, smuggling the resulting solid pieces to her room, and then, when she was drowsy from the laudanum, set the frozen carbon dioxide on her bed and drawn the bed curtains. In the morning, there would have been no trace of the frozen gas, which would have sublimated completely in the intervening hours, suffocating her in the process. And if any excess carbon dioxide had been in the air, it would have dissipated by the maid opening the door, the windows, and the bed curtains. "But why?" Treddles exclaimed after he'd read the note. "Why go to such extraordinary lengths?" "So that her parents would think exactly as they did, that their daughter perished by the will of God, and not her own hand," said his wife sadly. They held on to each other for a while. At the end of this silence, Alice murmured, "Do you think, my dear, that Holmes is perhaps not a real person, but an entity Lord Ingram made up, so that he wouldn't intimidate us with his vastly superior intelligence?"
"That is brilliant, my dear. Why have I not thought of it before?"
"Oh, because it's brilliant," she laughed. He pulled her to him for an affectionate kiss. Mere weeks after that, Treddles plucked up his courage and wrote to Lord Ingram to request help from Holmes. His career was on a healthy path. Had he married a woman of his own social class, he would have been content to let promotions come in time. But Alice had given up a life of luxury to become his wife. He was never going to be a rich man. The least he could do was to become highly successful and respected in his profession, in as little time as possible, and make her proud. The case in question concerned a body discovered aboard a P&O liner that had set sail from Port Said. The passenger was identified as an Egyptologist named Rendell. He had been dead at least a day, and by his side was a note that, according to his family and friends, was most certainly written in his own hand. The note read, "The curse of the pharaohs is real. Wilkinson has leapt overboard in a fit of madness, and now I feel its grip on me. A darkness descends. I can't breathe. Can no one help me?"
The mummies that had been brought back in the cargo did not look particularly menacing to Treddles as far as mummies went, and the sarcophagi that contained them seemed pedestrian, remarkable in neither beauty nor worth. One of the ship's officers recalled that approximately 36 hours before the steamer's arrival in Southampton, an agitated Rendell had demanded that the vessel be turned around to search for his friend. He declared that Wilkinson had been in a state ever since Gibraltar and had remained confined to his room, shaking in terror at the mummy's spectres. But now he was nowhere to be found, and Rendell was convinced he was bobbing in the Atlantic. The officer had pointed out that Wilkinson might have been nothing more than seasick, and perhaps having recovered, he had taken to shipboard society with fervour, to make up for lost time. It was scarcely unheard of for passengers to be found inebriated in nooks and crannies, or in the company of friendly widows. Rendell, miffed that his concern wasn't taken seriously, stormed off, and the officer was now experiencing remorse. Perhaps he ought to have believed the poor man. Treddles was not one to dismiss the supernatural out of hand, but neither was he convinced that malevolent spirits lingered for millennia, waiting to ambush hapless Egyptologists. He sent Rendell's body to the coroner and laid out the facts of the case for Lord Ingram to pass on to Holmes. A response came the next day. "Dear Inspector, I have received the following from Holmes," quoted verbatim. "It is possible there is more than one intrigue at play. The first involves a deception. Two young men set out for Egypt with high hopes of a tremendous find. They returned with sadly ordinary artifacts. There would be no fame and fortune waiting in England, only the disappointment of fathers who had financed the expedition. What to do? Ah, yes, the curse of the pharaohs. If they could stage something dramatic, Rendell comatose and Wilkinson missing, the public might be intrigued enough to pay to see those objects, the removal of which incited the wrath of the spirits." Rendell's conversation with the ship's officer was clearly meant to give the impression that Wilkinson had leapt overboard. Since no one saw that happen, the possibilities are twofold. One, Wilkinson disembarked in Gibraltar. Two, he did so at Southampton. The likelihood is that Wilkinson remained on the ship to tamper with the draft Rendell was to take. Rendell went to his death in blithe ignorance of his friend's treachery. Wilkinson then disembarked with the rest of the crowd before Rendell was found dead. As for why Wilkinson cooked up this entire elaborate scheme to do away with Rendell, since no financial trouble or professional jealousy has been mentioned, let us say, cherchez la femme. Wish you success in your endeavour. Ashburton. The dead man's fiancée turned out to be a very beautiful young woman. Wilkinson was found in Southampton, waiting for an opportune moment to pretend to have lately reached England. And Holmes was almost exactly right about how it had been done, except that the curse of the pharaoh had been Rendell's idea, which Wilkinson co-opted for his own purpose. The case had firmly secured the favour of his superiors for Treddles, and he had very much wished to thank Holmes. But Lord Ingram had refused all offers of gratitude on Holmes's behalf. "Holmes wants only an occupied mind. Everything else is secondary." What does Holmes do, then, when there aren't perplexing riddles to be solved? "You do not wish to know," said Lord Ingram. And then, after a moment, "Perhaps I should have said, I do not wish to know." An answer that did nothing to dispel Inspector Treddles's conviction that Lord Ingram and Holmes were most likely one and the same. Since then, he had consulted Holmes via Lord Ingram two more times, still surprised on each occasion by the resolute agility of the mind on the other end of the correspondence. Holmes was becoming, had become, if Treddles were entirely honest with himself, an institution in his life, a venerated institution, and now that institution had crumbled. Treadles pushed aside the evening newspapers littering his desk and pinched the bridge of his nose. He'd found no article about any homes suffering from a carriage mishap, a tumble into the Thames, or a botched medical procedure. A discreet inquiry to his colleagues had yielded similarly barren results. No dispute taken too far, robbery gone wrong, or attempted murder that left a man in a deep coma. For that had to be it, hadn't it? A deep coma? What else could Lord Ingram possibly mean by Holmes being alive, yet completely beyond his reach? His wife, in a lilac dressing gown printed with a paisley pattern, came into the room.
"Nothing, eh?"
He shook his head. "Nothing." Alice sighed.
"Poor Mr. Holmes. Whatever could the matter be?"
Treadles could only continue to shake his head. As an investigator, he had decent instincts, and his instincts told him that he was in the wilderness with regard to the misfortunes of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, not even near the right track, let alone following it.
"And I've certainly been put into my place," Alice went on. "Given that Lord Ingram and Mr. Holmes aren't remotely the same person."
"Well, I, for one, thought your hypothesis was remarkably elegant. It really is too bad that sometimes inconvenient facts surface to thumb their noses at remarkably elegant hypotheses."
"Pooh to inconvenient facts."
She came around and laid a hand on his shoulder. With her other hand, she turned the pages of the papers.
"Ludwig II of Bavaria found dead. Fire destroys nearly 1,000 buildings in Vancouver, British Columbia. What an age we live in. Bad news from the entire world, delivered right to our doorsteps."
She selected a different paper.
"Not that news from home is much better. Recriminations over the failure of the Irish Home Rule Bill. Police still looking for suspects in the fire in Lambeth that destroyed a building and killed two."
"I know about that building in Lambeth," said Treadles. "Every last inspector in Scotland Yard got letters about it. And it isn't even a copper hell, but a bookmaker's. You close one down and it opens right back up two streets over."
She flipped a page. "Even society news is no help. Lord Sheridan's birthday celebration cancelled due to a death in the family."
"It would be a newspaper that turns no profit if it reported only fires that didn't burn any houses, and parties that took place as expected."
Treadles kissed the palm of her hand.
"Fortunately for me, whenever I see the mistress of my household, I feel as if I have received an abundance of good news."
She smiled. "Ah, Inspector Treadles, I do love you. Come. Lay aside the mysterious fate of Mr. Sherlock Holmes for the moment. For you know this much flattery will lead nowhere, sir, except straight to the marriage bed."
Inspector Treadles needed no further prompting to serve his lady.
4. "Thank God for Great Aunt Maribel," Livia said thickly.
Great-aunt Maribel, a spinster, had lived to be 83. When she died, she left Livia an entire crate of her own creative endeavours, embroidery, glazed pottery, and watercolour paintings, all amateurish work that displayed little talent and even less effort. Livia, unpacking the crate, had grown increasingly dismayed. Was this really how life was lived for a spinster, full of long, idle hours that must be filled with useless crafts? Halfway through the contents, she'd come across an envelope addressed to her, with a note inside.
"Ha! You thought I'd wasted decades on this lot of rubbish, didn't you?
No, my dear. I have been well satisfied with my life, and hope you will be too in time. But until then, a bit of consolation to assist you in getting through those more trying years. I don't know about you, but I always need a stiff drink after a visit with your parents.
The bottom of the crate, underneath all the artistic flotsam, was lined with liquid gold. Whiskey from every distillery on the Isle of Islay. Calvados, Madeira, sherry, good vintages of claret, even two bottles of absinthe. Livia had carefully stowed this most marvellous bequest. She had since been frugal with it. She didn't want to squander her only source of wealth before her most desperate hour. Well, this was somebody's most desperate hour. She'd say it was Charlotte's, but Charlotte was holding herself together rather well. Instead, it was Livia who couldn't stop swallowing gulp after gulp of sweet Madeira. Livia who couldn't stop shaking and weeping. Livia who ranted and cursed.
"He's such an imbecile, that Roger Shrewsbury! Such an utter, irredeemable, mutton-headed dolt!"
She waved the bottle for emphasis.
"Oh, God, Charlotte! Of all the amoral and reckless married men to be had in London, why did you pick him?"
Charlotte sat on the windowsill, her feet on top of a packed suitcase. Livia had hours ago shed her blouse and corset to swaddle herself in an old, comfortable dressing gown. Charlotte remained in her day dress, a summery confection of cream silk, printed with roses and climbing vines. Livia preferred her garments as unadorned as possible, but Charlotte relished a good ruffle, yards of lace, and the most dramatic tassels swinging from the shiniest cords of braided silk. "You are more upholstered than a dowager's boudoir," Livia had once said to Charlotte, exasperated by the latter's "more is always better" taste. And Charlotte had laughed and countered,
"Didn't I tell you? Great Aunt Maribel always said that I reminded her of her favourite needlepoint footstool."
Tears welled in Livia's eyes. She drank directly from the bottle.
"I'm going to smash something into Roger Shrewsbury's face the next time I see him."
"Oh, I can't condone that," said Charlotte. "Mr. Shrewsbury's face is his only contribution to humanity. I recommend you instead smash something into his derriere, which is rather ordinary and not as worthy of preservation."
Livia gasped in shock and hiccuped at the same time.
"You saw his derriere?"
"I saw his everything. Even the parts usually covered by a fig leaf in the British Museum."
Did it hurt?"
"If you speak of the act of penetration, it wasn't exactly pleasurable, but it was no agony. Far more unpleasant was the fact that I had to go through such extreme measures in a bid for a modicum of freedom."
Livia rubbed her eyes.
"Do you really think that would have got you what you wanted? Our parents don't strike me as the sort to reward what they'd consider gross misconduct with what they weren't willing to provide you when you were being an obedient daughter."
"Which is why I'd have blackmailed them."
Livia choked mid-swallow.
"What? How?"
"By threatening to reveal to the general public that I'd been ruined, and hope that they'd cough up enough hush money for me to be educated." The audacity of Charlotte's plan made Livia light-headed. Or was it the Madeira?
She set down the bottle.
"Oh, Charlotte!"
The tears that had long stung the back of her eyes at last spilled down her cheeks.
"You won't be all alone in that horrid cottage, Charlotte, I promise you. I'll come around every time Mama and Papa aren't looking. I'll bring you books and newspapers. I'll bring you cake. I'll bring you..."
Charlotte peered at the curtain gap.
"Papa is leaving to visit Mrs. Marsh."
Mrs. Marsh was Sir Henry's current paramour. She, like Mrs. Gladwell, enjoyed rubbing the fact that she was sleeping with Sir Henry in Lady Holmes's face.
"I hope she gives him something dreadful," said Livia vehemently.
"No, then Mama might get it too, and that wouldn't be fair to her." Charlotte looked back at Livia. "Anyway, Papa going out means Mama has taken her laudanum and gone to bed. Will you please check to make sure she's fast asleep, Livia?"
Livia rose unsteadily to her feet.
"I can, but why? Can you check first, please?"
Livia did as she was asked, her brain foggy, but there was no doubt about it. Lady Holmes was snoring. She reported her findings to Charlotte, who led her to a room at the back of the house. There Charlotte opened a window.
"Moo, as loudly as you can, please."
"What?" Livia was extraordinarily good at imitating animal sounds, a most useless talent for a lady except for entertaining her baby sister when they were little. She hadn't mooed in years.
"Please, it'll be a signal to Mott."
Mott was their groom and coachman, and gardener too when the family was in town.
"But why do you want to signal Mott?"
"I'll explain. But please hurry. It'll be past his bedtime soon, and I don't want him to go to sleep, thinking he's no longer needed." Livia wondered if she were roaring drunk, or perhaps Charlotte was. The moo emerged with surprising vigour, if also plenty of unintended tremolo. She moaned,
"I sound like the bovine version of a fishwife toward the end of an argument."
"But a victorious one," said Charlotte. An unconvincing "baa" came back from the news. Charlotte nodded.
"Mott's heard us. Now will you tell me what's going on?"
"All right," said Charlotte, guiding Livia back to their room. "But you must promise not to say anything to anyone."
"I promise. What is it?"
Charlotte shut the door and began to unbutton her dress.
"I'm leaving."
"I know that." Her suitcases had been packed for the rail journey on the morrow that would see her confined to the country for the foreseeable future.
"I wish Mama didn't have such a bee in her bonnet about my staying put for the rest of the season. To prove what point? I'd rather we be locked away in the country together."
"We will neither of us be locked away in the country," said Charlotte. "Mott is bringing round the carriage. He'll take me to one of the bigger hotels near Trafalgar Square, where the clerks won't find it so strange that an unaccompanied woman comes to ask for a room at this hour. Tomorrow I'll find a place in a boarding house."
Livia shook her head. Was she hearing things? "You can't be serious. You're running away?"
"I am not. I am of age. I am free to leave my parents' home and set up my own establishment. It only appears as if I'm running away because I don't want our parents interfering with my plans."
"My God, you're running away."
For the first time, Charlotte raised the glass of Madeira Livia had poured for her hours ago, an odd little smile on her face.
"All right, I'm running away. I prefer being on my own to being locked up in the country."
"But Charlotte, how will you know where to find a boarding house, or which ones are suitable for a lady?"
"Work and Leisure publishes a curated list from time to time. It's a magazine aimed at women who work or are seeking employment. I've memorized the most recent list, since we only hire a house for the season, and I knew I must live in London year-round if I was to be educated here." Of course Charlotte would have committed such a list to memory, but the discussion made Livia feel as if she were suspended high in the air by nothing more than embroidery threads. Neither she nor Charlotte knew anything firsthand about life outside the boundaries of their upbringing.
But you'll have to pay to be lodged, won't you?"
"Yes, I have a few pounds put away, but I also plan to find work."
"What kind of work?" You've become notorious, Charlotte. You won't ever become the headmistress of a school. You won't even be able to work as a governess or a lady's companion. True. But there are positions that do not require me to take charge of other people's daughters, or pollute someone else's home with my infamy.